Good evening, everyone. And last week, we began exploring a bit of the allegorical interpretations of the Song of Songs, and our main character was Rabbi Akiva, and his objection of perceiving the Song of Songs in some kind of profane manner. And his declaration that the Song of Songs is the Holy of Holies, and therefore nobody can even think that it should not be part of the biblical canon. And then we've seen one possible interpretation, one possible allegorical or actually midrashic interpretation by Rabbi Akiva, or attributed to Rabbi Akiva, to the Song of Songs, and that is the whole dialogue between the heroine of the Song of Songs and the daughters of Jerusalem, and this is interpreted by Rabbi Akiva as some kind of dialogue between Israel and the other nations, the nations of the world, in which they discuss God, who is actually the male lover of the song. So the relationship, and this is the first time we've encountered this up until now, the relationship between this love story between the woman and the man in the Song of Songs becomes a relationship between Israel and God. The daughters of Jerusalem turn into the nations of the world, and the whole drama becomes some kind of political drama, or well, religious and political drama. We've discussed that actually these two are intertwined and cannot be separated from each other. And into this, we've seen that Rabbi Akiva is also doing some kind of radical interpretive move in which he uses the word alamot, which means in Hebrew maidens, and rereads it as admot, until death, and therefore this love story becomes some sort of tale of martyrdom. Why do the Jews, why are they willing to die for their God slash lover? And there we've seen some that this love story, which is rather, although one would say rather ideal and beautiful in the biblical text, although we've seen also some kind of dark undercurrent in that text as well, here becomes much more sinister and has a historic and captures an historical moment in which the relationship between God and Israel is not that harmonious, and therefore it actually, in order to make sense of the Song of Songs, it also has to entail the destruction of the temple, the occupation by the Romans, the martyrs. All of these become part of this love story, and this love story turns into a much more complex one. I think these were the main issues we've discussed last week. What I would like to do today, this session will have two halves, hopefully. I want to take a look on two more moments of one of rabbinic interpretation and one of early Christian interpretation of the Song of Songs in the same vein of reading the text allegorically, and then we move to another dimension of this question of interpretation through the question of space, the space in the Song of Songs and the way it has been interpreted. So if you have the text from last week, so I'm in page number 3 of our text. And this is from the Talmud, from the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud. This is one, what we're going to see now is actually one of many, many, many similar interpretations taking place all over rabbinic literature in the Talmud and in the Midrash, taking verses from the Songs of Songs and understanding them as relating to Israel, if they relate to the woman, the female lover. Or to God, if it relates to the male lover. This, you can find this all over the place in rabbinic literature. What I'm choosing here is not necessarily unique, but it's a good example of many other possible interpretations. I'm text number 4, okay, from Bava Batra. I actually took a fragment out of its context, which is a wider halachic discussion about walls, which is irrelevant to this specific fragment, but what we have here is a short debate or discussion between two prominent rabbis. One is Rabbi Yochanan and one is Resh Lakish. These two are have been a chavruta together. They study together, have been opponents of each other in their scholarship. And they have a discussion as to how to interpret one verse in the Song of Songs. And I really want to give you just a flavor of what kind of interpretations are in the air, and then we'll see how this how we can move on from there. So when Resh Lakish came before Rabbi Yochanan, the latter, Rabbi Yochanan, said to him, "Why did you not derive the lesson, some kind of halachic lesson that they discussed earlier, from this verse? I am a wall, and my breasts are like towers." Yeah, we've seen this. This is one of the ending verses of the Song of Songs. So, and here is how Rabbi Yochanan understands this verse. Where "I am a wall" refers to the Torah, and "my breasts are like towers" to the students of the Torah. So, his Rabbi Yochanan's interpretation, and again, this is out of context, but the context is not important for this specific interpretation. His interpretation is that "I am a wall" is the Torah. The Torah speaks. So here, the woman, the female lover of the Song of Songs, is not exactly Israel, but the Torah, and the Torah speaks, and she is a wall. "And my breasts are like towers to the students of the Torah." So we have "I am a wall," and my "and my breasts are like towers." Says Rabbi Yochanan, "I am a wall." This refers to the Torah, and "my breasts are like towers" to the students of the Torah. Good question. Let's finish the paragraph and then we'll ask the question. Okay? It's the question to be asked. So Resh Lakish, however, adopts the exposition of the verse given by Rabbah, which is, "I am a wall" refers to the community of Israel.
Saying, "I am a wall" refers to the community of Israel.
"And my breasts are like towers" refers to synagogues
and houses of study.
Okay. So these are the two interpretations given in this specific paragraph to this verse. And now the big question is why. Let's return to this question. The first thing we have, which cries out, is that obviously for them, and for them it's already not a question of debate. This is already their presupposition when they come to discuss the text, is that the Song of Songs does not deal with the feminine body itself. So if we have a woman speaking of herself as a wall and her breasts as towers, this must mean something else. If you recall Origins, what we've opened up with Origins, the father of the church, statement that you have, in order to understand the text, you have to be purged by all bodily desires, and you don't have to have any tinge of flesh and blood in you in order to read the book. So here we have something slightly similar in this sense, that this very specific reference to a female body does not deal with a female body. This is something they're certain of. I mean, nobody here will say that this talks about a woman's body. This they bypass in various ways, but they bypass.
Were there any rabbis who did not agree with that?
Which says this is specifically
is there any rabbis that thought it?
To my knowledge, if there are, they are a very, very small minority in rabbinic texts. You will find later on a bit in medieval Jewish interpretations, some will return to the text itself and return to a more bodily, human reading of the text, and they will also be in the minority. From this moment onwards, the mainstream of Jewish interpretation, of rabbinic interpretation, will take this as an allegory in these ways. So not necessarily these specific interpretations. Some would say, okay, I don't know, this is the Mount Sinai, or this is the Beit HaMikdash, the temple. They will go in either other directions, but they usually will refrain from understanding it literally. Yeah.
Speaking.
Right. So we'll try to understand who is the I speaking. This is a very good question. It's a very good aspect we have to deal.
So if everybody is trying to get away from the bodily aspects of a song, but the song is actually written as a love song.
Yeah.
Why is this a shift? Why is this big counter? Why? Are they either scared of the body,
mm-hmm.
or are they just reading something else that the original was telling us? In other words, this is a love song.
Yeah.
Period. End of story. Nothing else. Nothing about cities and synagogues and this and that.
Yeah.
Just read it as it is.
Right.
Why have we gone this far?
Yeah. I think perhaps the answer is both. On the one hand, obviously they are either scared or against, or they refuse to accept what they might consider too low or profane, or we would call perhaps secular reading of this book. Because if it's in the Bible, in their logic, it cannot mean what we think it means. Yeah. Otherwise, it cannot be. Then, if this is a love song, then it has nothing to do here. It only if it has a deeper meaning, another, even in their logic, yeah. Then we can consider it the Holy of Holies. My second answer perhaps will, but then the second answer would say something not exactly what you're saying. We'll reach that option later on in this course, but. On the other hand, you can think that the fact that they are choosing the Song of Songs to discuss, for example, their relationship with God, and we didn't still deal with the specifics of this text yet, but to discuss, they might be, in a sense, relocating eroticism and saying, okay, they deny this the human flesh and blood erotic option as one which will hold the book, but they will make it into their main metaphor in order to discuss other relationships. So in a sense, Eros is being transferred. Yeah, that is perhaps the best word.
It's problematic because what's going on is an eroticization. Whatever they choose, towers are, and they're making synagogues erotic, making the Torah erotic.
Yeah. I think, in a sense, I mean, you can read it in two ways, and both, I think, are valid. And one is saying, in a sense, they are de-eroticizing the Song of Songs. Because if you say, okay, these are the synagogues, the breasts are synagogues, and this is then what's left of the eros of the Song of Songs? Another option is saying, well, they're not de-eroticizing the Song of Songs, they are eroticizing the synagogues. And both options are valid, and perhaps it's maybe they're doing both at the same time. But we'll try and see where this is leading us. But yes, please, you want to... If her body is a wall, I mean, if her body is defined as a wall, then these are, I don't know, either the defenses or...
horizontal towers.
But he says the wall is the Torah.
Yeah, now we'll have to see how this works in the Midrash. We didn't really delve into this yet, into the specifics of how they understand this, but we'll do this in a minute.
But, yes. But aside from the Midrash, I saw it as... she's soft, but she wants to show that she's strong. So she says, I'm soft, but I'm actually very strong and hard. I'm a wall. And her breasts are the softest part of her, what she says, but they're actually towers.
Yeah.
So she's trying to show that she, or whoever's writing is trying to show that she's trying to be very, very strong.
Yeah, okay. And this is the Bible. This makes sense about it. We'll see how if we can transfer this to the Midrash. Yes.
Now, I get back to one of the comments raised earlier about this is a love song. And I think that's at the most base level, that's certainly an inescapable conclusion. When I read, and my breasts are like towers, I'm thinking stacked, you know, towers. It's talking about breasts, not synagogues or community. So, really, but here's my question to you. Once this was accepted into the canon, then I understand that later generations of rabbis had no choice but to try to deal with the implications of it.
Yeah.
But before it was accepted into the canon, there was a lot of disagreement about this.
Mm-hmm.
There must have been rabbis who said, are you kidding? We're not going to take this into the Bible. This is a filthy, dirty love song that's appropriate to be sung in a bar, which is not exactly why they say
no.
Whoever sings this song in the bar. So the answer is, I think that there were rabbis opposed to this. However, once accepted, it's a problem. You know what? Now, the real question is, so what argument won him over? Because Rabbi Akiva, it was Rabbi Akiva against everybody, and he won him over.
Yeah.
He wanted it in?
He wanted. We've seen this in the. When we've seen the Mishnah on does the Song of Songs defile the hand? This is a story the Mishnah tells us. I can't really make an historical argument of it because the Mishnah tells the story much later, once the text is already in the canon, right? So it's not exactly a. It's in retrospect, but the story the Mishnah wants us to learn, the story the Mishnah wants us to know. I can't say anything about what really happened. I really can't. But the story the Mishnah wants us to know is that this has been debated. Rabbi Akiva wasn't a minority. There were other voices. Rabbi Akiva is the one saying, "Don't even consider debating it." He's like, "Don't. It's not even about. It's not open for discussion. This is it." That's Rabbi Akiva's extreme position. There were others debating, and some saying yes, some saying no. We do not have their justifications. Why they said yes or why they said no? The only person really expressing a longer view is Rabbi Akiva, and he himself is only saying this is the Holy of Holies. He doesn't say more than that. So they tell us the story of a debate. They don't really give us the specifics of it. And we can't tell what won them over. I mean, it's possible, you can think of it, you can think of it the other way around, that this has been canonized before the story of the debate, and the story of the debate is also a pseudo-historical story trying to explain retroactively why this is in. And this has been canonized perhaps for other reasons, which we don't know, which are not even part of this debate. So that when the rabbis already get the Song of Songs as an established fact. It's part of the canon. Now deal with it.
Was it put into the canon close to the time that it was written, or much later?
Possibly. Well, the latest date of the writing of the Song of Songs, or at least editing the Song of Songs in this current state, is the 3rd century before the Common Era. And usually we discuss the canonization process to take place in the 2nd or 1st century before. So it's like 100, 200 years later. The Mishnah we've seen of the discussion with Rabbi Akiva has been edited at least in 200 after the Common Era. In the Common Era. So this, again, it might be an older documentation of a real debate taking place or a later fabrication of such a debate. We can't really tell. But we do know, I think we discussed it, that in almost all pre-rabbinic evidence that we have of what the canon is, the Song of Songs is part of it. We find it in Qumran, in the Dead Sea Scrolls. There are fragments of the Song of Songs together with other books of the Bible. Eusebius Flavius Josephus, when he writes his history, discusses the Song of Songs as part of the Hebrew Bible. So we already have, before this Mishnah, evidence that this has been part of the canon, but we have no evidence of why. It's possible that whoever put it in thought it's a beautiful text and didn't want to lose it and just put it in. And then later on, the rabbis who were perhaps more strict on giving this religious meaning had to do all this process of interpretation. It's a possible story we can tell, but it's I don't know. I don't know, not to my knowledge.
Maybe he just said this is it.
But the royal house by this time, I mean, during this, when we speak of the end of the writing of a song, is we're already in the Hellenistic period. We don't have that royal house having such kind of political power. So I would doubt that. But I don't know. That's my hand. I'm sorry. Yes, David.
I didn't want to say that. You have to keep in mind that Rabbi Akiva speaks about the Holy Spirit. It's already making an interpretation that is not right. It's like a reason to die for, like, defending Jerusalem in a political and a war meaning. Like, it's taking like a war, like a weapon, changing the whole meaning of the text, saying the Queen and Jerusalem and the Am Israel have to defend it until the death, like in the war that he was speaking about. So, he's discussing that you have to be in the canon or not. It's already seeing the text not heroic, like in a war, from a war perspective. I think that in this point, what he's talking about is the same line that same that most of the people that is studying Torah are like soldiers. Yeah, it's already done, that is not a road. It's a war test.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's like now, like the Haredim today. They say that they don't go to the army, but to study the Torah. It's like, also, I heard the Torah is more dangerous than the tank. So now here is different, what he's saying. Like when he says that the war is the Torah, it's already the discourse about war and defending Jerusalem, it's already accepted. The erotic, like any religious people, it's comfortable with the religion. And already,
uncomfortable.
Already it's like a war test, and now it's defending the fact that the people who study enough, it's also like a soldier.
It's a good point. I think we do want to consider, however, the option that both martyrdom and war have erotic aspects to them. I mean, that in a sense, definitely when you read martyr stories, both early Christians and the story of even of the death of Rabbi Akiva, it's discussed as some kind of love relationship. It's like the utmost token of love, the willingness to die for, and sometimes also of ecstasy. And we can say something similar perhaps to some kind of discourse of war that is itself eroticized. So perhaps we have some kind of triangle here. I agree, this is a strong reading what you're suggesting, that the towers are already being seen in metaphors of fortifications and not in any erotic metaphor. But perhaps the fortifications are also an erotic metaphor in some kind of, you can think of discourse of conquest, of which is warlike and sexual many times. Yes, please. Yes.
I'm adding on to what you said quickly, is that I don't really agree with what you said. I think that while, first thing, I don't think that Haredim or ultra-religious are uncomfortable specifically with eroticism or sexuality, I think that it just has a very specific place.
Mm-hmm.
And, rather good than point. The place that we give it in secular society or in more, I don't know, raw society, I think there's a very specific place for it, and I think that it's used very, very strategically in lots of places all over religion.
Yeah.
And to say that it's uncomfortable is putting our meaning and our box that we put around sexuality
mm-hmm.
in their yard.
That's
and
good point.
I think that's really, I don't know, it's kind of unfair. And also, in terms of what you were saying, sexuality in this sense has that place that they give it. And
mm-hmm.
if it's given it, even if it's war, exactly what you said. There is sexuality here no matter what you do with it.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not between a man and a woman in a bed, but sexuality nonetheless, and eroticism and something that is stripped from other places, that, like in other places of the Bible, you don't see this.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well,
thank you.
Pretty
thank you.
Strange if the students of the Torah and the Torah have a sexual
Actually, well, first of all, we'll see this as well. I don't know if we will see it here, but you can see it. For example, this is very strong in the Zohar, in the book of the Zohar, the masterpiece of medieval Kabbalistic writing, in which the Torah is likened almost to Rapunzel. She's a princess hiding in her tower, and she kind of sometimes peeps out of the window, and the scholar is her lover trying to enter the tower. And then there's a very a long and rather eroticized description of how once he enters the tower, she kind of unveils herself, her secrets, one after, almost some kind of like a scholarly striptease moment in which the Torah is taking off one layer of meaning and another layer of meaning, and then and the scholar understands more and more and more. So you have this image, a really erotic image, not so much in the Talmud, although a bit, but really strongly in the Zohar, of the act of reading and the act of learning as an erotic experience between a feminine Torah and a masculine reader or scholar. So actually, it's nothing is impossible in this imagery. Yes, you want. It's a danger. We have this danger, I think, and possibly yes. I mean, perhaps after what's your name, please? Yeah. Elizabeth. What Elizabeth just said is that no matter how much we would interpret, or how I understand Elizabeth, how I interpret Elizabeth, is that no matter how much you interpret it, the text still has some kind of claim. So no matter what, the text is not lost if you say breasts are like towers. Even, I mean, because it's there. And so there's some more of a tension, in a sense, between the original text, which does have some claim over the interpretation, and our interpretation of it, no matter how far-fetched it might be. The tension is still there because the verses are here. We do not erase them. We do not discard them.
Yeah, but our eyes don't actually see the text. They are no longer looking at the original text in the way.
Yeah, this is true.
Now at the rabbi before them.
Yeah.
Who said X.
This is true.
It's there.
But it's there, and
absolutely.
I think this is something even it's a wider phenomenon, wider than specifically the Song of Songs. The way the rabbis discuss scripture, they don't really have, most of the time, or at least we don't have much evidence that they have a notion of a literal meaning of what in Hebrew we'd call pshat, the meaning, the text as it is. For them, what we usually call a midrash is something much more dynamic, in which the text is much, it doesn't have like one fixed meaning which is there and then we do with it whatever we want. There is some kind of question, is there really a one literal meaning, or is the text there in order to be in some kind of constant dynamic dialogue with us? And therefore, again, they never have a manifesto of how they read text, but when we see what they do, very, very rarely, it happens sometimes, that you find this rabbi kind of popping up his head and saying, but this is not what is written here, and suddenly he's saying what is written here. Usually, they allow themselves this playful, perhaps, again, far-fetched work with the text. So, yes?
This is exactly what the thing is, like, when we have a bread, and then the bread is really a tower, and then the tower is a synagogue. It's not that the synagogue is a bread. It's because we first think that it's a tower and it's good for defending. After that, they said, no, the synagogue is a thing that's worth it. And this is the process of the reinterpretation.
Yeah, you said there's already in the text itself there's an image. So the image, in fact, saying the tower is a synagogue is not that far-fetched. Saying the breasts are like towers are like synagogues, that process.
Sure.
And yet they read. I would say, there are many, you know, contradictions to this. First of all, one thing that we do have to be cautious of is not reading back the Haredi community into the rabbis. This is not the same. I mean, they might be their descendants, but this is not the same. They don't have the same religiosity and not the same also. Relationship to the body. So there are connections because Haredi communities and not only Haredi communities read these texts and somehow discuss them, but this doesn't reflect back on the text themselves. This might.
Of course, there is a rabbinic teaching that if your Yetzer is getting the best of you, take them to the Bet HaMidrash.
Right, and
you get them under control.
Right, that's the place to.
So they saw that.
But I would say one more thing about this, and this is the fact that, again, the Song of Songs is there, and children read it. I mean, there is some kind of the canonization of this text offers in religious communities offers some kind of multitude of contradictions, because you read it allegorically, but on the other hand, it's accessible. I recall myself as a religious child, kind of. Having access to a text that my parents will never allow me in any other circumstances, and learning words, and there is some kind of so the fact that it has been canonized actually, and the text is there, and it has some kind of strange access, actually allows many things to happen to a specific reader. I mean, and the dynamics, the specific dynamics of one individual reader with this text, the fact that the moment he or she has access to it. Is wider than the way what society wants to make of this text. And so, returning perhaps to your point, no matter how much you'll interpret it, the text is present. And once it's present, you can't really control what it does. I mean, entirely. You can control some of it, and perhaps, you know, but it's present. In a sense, yes. In a sense, yeah. It's not easy.
How was it?
Embarrassing. Mainly embarrassing. I'm sorry. How was it to read the Shir Shirim as a young child? So I say it was embarrassing, mainly.
It was embarrassing?
As a kid? Yeah.
But did you study
No, but we didn't study in school, but we read it in the synagogue.
Did they teach it in school?
No, I don't think no, although we did study other, you know, sexually explicit moments in the Bible, but not the Song of Songs. No.
It seems to me that...
Never thought of that, but no.
It seems to me that the first question anybody has to ask about the Song of Songs is, why is it there? And once you accept that it's there, and therefore must be like the rest of the text in the Bible, i.e., mm-hmm. holy, holy of holies, then the next question is to not ask why it's there, but to talk about what its content is. So what is its religious or spiritual meaning? And it doesn't seem a big jump for the rabbis to look at this text and say it must fit in with the values that we accept as the values of Jewish life, mm-hmm. our values. And so to take the jump from an erotic text to comparing it to values that they're familiar with is not an unreasonable jump at all. Otherwise, what else are they going to do with the text?
Yes.
They can't accept it as an erotic text, and so it has to have some Jewish values. It's Torah, Israel,
yeah.
Students of the Torah, the Knesset, and stuff like that. So I'm not at all shocked that they would do that. Not that I think that they're on target, but I think that they need to make that jump.
I think. But here I want to return to your comment that there is an I speaking. There is still, and this I think is something we do need to think of, because
I am a wall, and my breasts are like towers. Here the Torah is the speaker, right? The I is the Torah speaking, and we have a notion, a feminine image of the Torah already in rabbinic text, that the Torah is a woman, or she's the daughter of God sometimes she's the wife of God, sometimes she's the bride of Israel. There are many possible relationships there. And she speaks, and the students of the Torah are the breasts. And here we have an interesting moment, which I want to explore for a minute, because it has possible surprising consequences. The students of the Torah are the people saying this interpretation. I mean, the students... So we have Rabbi Yochanan in this case saying, I am the breast of the Torah, right? Or something to this degree, right? Because we, the community of scholars, are the Torah's breast. Or, if we take Resh Lakish's interpretation, then all of Israel, not just the scholars, are the woman, right? Saying, I am a wall. And here we have a moment, this I is actually, I think, a tricky moment in a sense, because we have a community of men, possibly just men, doing this kind of interpretation, either collectively identifying themselves as a woman, or collectively identifying themselves as a woman's breasts, and allowing their image of themselves to have this kind of, I don't know, gender-bending moment in which they identify with themselves as the woman in this relationship, or perhaps even more shocking, as the woman's breast in this relationship. Now, we can think of why. I mean, what could be possible meanings of breast? You know, they give milk, but they're also some kind of... I mean, you can have possible meanings to what a breast can mean, but before we interpret what a breast would mean, this act itself is interesting. The fact that a community of just men, only men, identify with themselves as the woman or as parts of her body, in relationship to their God.
Why?
I don't know yet, but they do it.
You spoke about that, and you spoke about the animus and anima,
mm-hmm.
as part of the psychology.
I spoke about that?
Really get into that too much, but within every woman is
mm-hmm.
an inside part that is masculine,
mm-hmm.
and within every man is an inside part that is feminine,
yeah.
according to Now, I don't know if this is true, but it does seem that...
Did I say that?
No, you did not. I don't know if this is true, but it does seem that it would explain understanding yourself as a giver,
mm-hmm.
or as something that has to be protected,
mm-hmm.
and is under siege. This would be me imagining,
yeah.
being a male animal.
Yeah.
It would be so far-fetched to understand that we have both elements.
It's possible. And then they allow themselves to identify or to express this mm-hmm. aspect of their own aspect of femininity through identifying with her.
Certainly at a biochemical level, it's true. Mm-hmm. We have the same hormones, just right. different proportions.
Right.
So, why not? That
possible.
Could
be
how
yeah.
I think
yes,
that,
please.
It might have to do with, soldiers wear breastplates.
Mm-hmm.
The Ghanim wear breastplates.
Yeah. Right.
But soldiers have, like, armor, and probably the word for breast in Hebrew for male and for female are.
They don't have, no, it's not actually. The word here is shaddai, which is, but here would use shaddai, which is, it's specific female breasts.
But here, it's like my breasts are like towers, so they're saying, we are students of Torah, we are protecting the Torah, like the tower is protecting the wall.
Mm-hmm. Possible. Yeah, this could be a possible meaning of it, but it does accumulate, and we just have one possible fragment of it, and we'll see something very similar in origin in a minute in Christianity. It does accumulate, in a sense, to ongoing interpretation. The moment they identify the allegory, which is usually the common one, usually the common allegory would be that the male lover is God, and therefore the female lover is either them or sometimes the Torah. This would be the possible relationship they would make, but they as scholars of the Torah are part both of the community of Israel and of the Torah.
So I find it also interesting in terms of Torah. I mean, we discussed this once. You take the Torah out, you undress it, mm-hmm. you turn it up, kiss it. I mean,
yeah,
there's a whole thing going on.
That's true in the synagogues.
In the synagogue.
Right. True. True. And
quite a lot of enthusiasm. And you're not. It's just
a guy's right, true. And agreed. So you can see and you also have some reflections on that, on the Torah, not just as a body of knowledge, but as a specific artifact that is being hugged and kissed and undressed. So you do have that. But when they perceive themselves as... Now, again, this already has its... It has its origins in the Bible. We have this notion of Israel being God's bride in various moments. But here, because we have the I, this first person speaking, then they become this first person speaking in a woman's voice. They say, "We are like I am like a wall," or in other places say, "I am." The lily of the Sharon, or I am the roses of the valleys. I mean, they would use this self-person, the first-person feminine expression to talk about themselves with their relation to God, which is perceived as male. And this is an interesting moment, which I can't really say why, but why they do it. I mean, I can see what kind of structure they're working in. If there are some kind of erotic relationship with God, then God would be usually the male in this relationship. But it is interesting that they do it without. It seems to be a quite a natural flow for them to adopt this feminine role with relation to God. This is not something that passes what you said. The femininity and masculinity are so well defined that they cannot do this. I don't know, drag interpretation and enter the woman's voice and speak from it their desire, whatever. Yeah. The original interpretation, meaning?
But in fact, this is, we're saying that these are men,
mm-hmm.
Role.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it was actually thought of by women.
The interpretations themselves.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I didn't hear this option up until now.
Resh Lakish
was a woman? No. That Resh Lakish is quoting his wife.
That's interesting.
I didn't think of it.
Yeah.
That's interesting. The text doesn't tell us this. The text attributes it only to male voices because the Talmud is only male voices, usually.
Yeah.
Almost entirely. But is there a layer of a feminine voice between them? Possible? I don't know. I can't substantiate this in any way. Yes, David.
I wonder if we go back from that and we try to make one
just erotic and terminologic interpretation of the test. Like, I think if somebody says to somebody, your breath smells like sour, it's very clear what he's saying.
What is he saying? I don't know, Madonna's bra.
Like, the breath of young women that are like sour.
You know, this doesn't help as much.
Firm. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
This is the original. This is what the lover wants to say to her.
Mm-hmm.
No, but she said to herself.
She said about herself. My breasts are like towers.
She's telling him this is in the first person. My breasts.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe she's praising her own body.
So,
possible.
I mean, maybe they are firm. I mean, his heart is still well taken.
Like, referring the breath to the tower, I think that has that idea, like, being really erotic. And then I think that there's some people that want to make the test, like, something far away from the erotics, and, like, defending the city, and when they see power and war, they will run for it. And they say, no, this means that we have to die for the city.
I didn't get the second part. Can you repeat it, please?
They see power and war, they start to speak about war, they say, we can use it. And we can make an interpretation.
So return to the warlike, to the warlike symbol. I mean, they ignore the breasts and they kind of...
I don't know.
These rabbis.
Like, I think that my rabbi, he wasn't very comfortable with erotism. I don't think there's many. And I think that they try to run away from that idea.
But it's true, but if they would want to run away from this idea, they would just leave the Song of Songs alone. This is perhaps one of the most interpreted texts. I mean, they return to it again and again and again. And I agree there is a sense here, and I think there's something we need to take, you know, to discuss, that there is a sense that all of these allegorical interpretations are there is a movement of shying away from the concrete body. But on the other hand, they're using this concrete body time and again. I mean, and again, we're not talking about celibate rabbis. I mean, there are tensions and anxieties about sexuality in the Talmud all over the place. This cannot be denied, as probably in culture as a whole. But the fact that they are making this one of their most central texts and not kind of putting it aside and once in a while referring to it, but kind of, you know, attacking it again and again. I mean, we might perceive that part of the relationship is shying away, but it's possible, maybe not the whole picture. I don't know. I'm off. This is very, very open. All we have are these interpretations. We can't really, you know, we don't really know the psychology behind them, but we can try and see what they do.
But we also know something else. That other people were singing it in bars.
Right. That's true.
So maybe since it was in any case
around
popularly being propagated,
yeah,
they had to like really find a way to make it kosher and get people off that meaning. Mm.
So they have to put a lot of energies into interpreting it in order
maybe,
to.
Maybe
that's a good point. That's a good point. Yes, please. Yes, please.
Sorry.
You know, I don't mean to reduce this to simple historicism, but if it's true that Shir HaShirim was written, you know, if not by Melech David, then sometime, you know, under a Hasmonean dynasty.
Mm-hmm.
The point being, at a time when the Jews had some kind of military power and some kind of sovereignty and some kind of ability to control the force, the violence, then it's not so surprising to see the use of metaphors pertaining to military kinds of considerations.
True.
And the relationship between God and Israel can be seen as something which protects the Jews in some way. In a later generation, when Rav Yochanan and Reish Lakish lived, which is already after the destruction and after the loss of sovereignty, and they're already engaged in the big process of reinterpreting the whole story and making Judaism into some kind of a portable civilization that's about rule of law and all that kind of stuff. So it's very appropriate for their era to be interpreting, to be using, you know, the kinds of nurturing metaphors that you see there. And so you obviously can't use military metaphors because the Jews don't have much of a military option anymore. However, they're in the process of turning their religious civilization
into the basis of their identity, and that's what's going to take them forward. And also, we're in the diaspora as well, where most of them are by this point. So therefore, the similes are nurturing, and also in a way of protecting the Jews. So therefore, you see the choice of what are the breasts? The breasts are the form, are the means of nurturing the infant and enabling it to grow and thrive. And therefore, the students of the Torah, which is a little bit of a self-serving thing,
for sure.
Who were the guys who authored all this stuff? They were exactly the students of the Torah. So they see themselves as the, not unfairly, as the primary mechanism for keeping the Jews around. And the same thing with the Reish Lakish. Interesting, you know, I don't know how literally you can take this, but, you know, in the Talmud, he's a guy that knows about violence.
Sure.
I mean, the guy was a highway robber. He was reformed by Rabbi Yochanan. That's really all. I mean, they're reflecting their historical...
So it's you're saying perhaps they actually are, I don't know if shying away, but moving away from the metaphors of war towards other metaphors. The war is what is actually, for them, the war-like metaphors are the ones that perhaps outdated for them or irrelevant for their kind of historical experience.
To their
yeah. Yes, please. Yes, please.
I just want to ask, this shows what I said in the first lesson, that I know nothing. Did other texts also have to be, were all, other texts also discussed before they were accepted as part of the canon? Is this the
yeah, no.
Everyone,
no.
Every text
no. No, there are process? Other books. No, not every text. All, we know
so
of... Yeah, most of them, again, from what we know from the rabbis themselves, and you have to take this with a pinch of salt. Is that discussed? A grain of salt. You have to, because this is a retroactive story. But we know that there has been a problem with the Song of Songs, a problem with Kohelet. We've seen in the same Mishnah with Ecclesiastes, probably a problem with Esther, and with Ezekiel. These are.
How about Eov?
Eov, I don't think. I don't recall. I don't know of, maybe there has, I don't recall any documentation of a problem with the Book of Job, to my knowledge. I know of problems with these four. Ezekiel is problematic. Ezekiel is mainly problematic because it has a long description of the temple. It has two problems. One, it has a long description of the temple, which contradicts the description of the temple we find in the Book of Kings. Very different, and so it's problematic in this sense, and it also has some very strong, descriptions of mystical experiences of watching seeing God and his Melkava, his chariot. So, and this is a very, very volatile text. So Ezekiel is problematic, and they want and they consider it a dangerous book that has to be at first, not necessarily interpreted. First, they wanted just to put it aside so nobody will ever read it. And then it has been fine, and then there has been a lot of discussion. So Ezekiel, Esther, because God doesn't appear in Esther, so it's also kind of a problem, and these two that we've discussed. This is, to my knowledge, the four books that has been problematic.
So it's just a process that eventually, by consensus, I'm sure it wasn't an official vote.
Yeah.
They describe
a vote. We historically we don't know how the canonization took place. It's a mystery. I mean, it could be a long process, maybe not just one body. I don't know. Some say they just kept the books that survived and put them together, which is problematic. We'll have other books from the period which are not in. We don't really know a lot about the process of canonization because these texts are much later. They describe. Interestingly enough, usually they discuss texts which are in the canon and they say these has been debated and it has been decided to put them in. We have no discussion of the rabbis of a text that has been debated and has been decided to be out. So they are already justifying what they have and not really reflecting about options that have been...
Don't they discuss Ecclesiasticus and some of the Svarim that in our or Hitzonim that we...
They do not. I mean, for example, Ben Sira, which is a book which is an outside of the canon from their time. The rabbis know of this book, and they sometimes even quote it, but they never discuss its canonization. They never discuss why it's out. This they don't discuss. They know the book, they refer to it, but they don't have a discussion of its canonization. They only have discussion of a canonizations of book which are in. So, in a sense, kind of reflecting about why are these books in, not necessarily reflecting on why other books are out. So it's only part of the picture, so we can't really tell. Let's read Origen before we take a short break. Origen, as we recall, is one of the fathers of the church, writing in the first century of the Common Era, so basically around the time of Rabbi Akiva and his fellow, around the same time. And this is part of his homilies on the Song of Songs, so just see that the language is not very different, perhaps, in a sense. For there is a certain spiritual embrace, and oh, that the bridegroom's more perfect embrace may enfold my bride. Then I too shall be able to say what is written in this same book, his left hand is under my head, and his right hand will embrace me. And if he will condescend to make my soul his bride too and come to her, how fair must she then be to draw him down from heaven to herself, to cause him to come down to earth, so that he may visit his beloved one. With what beauty must she be adorned, with what love must she burn, that he may say to her things which he said to the perfect bride about thy neck, thine eyes, thy cheeks, thy hands, thy shoulders, thy feet. It's pretty hot. Yeah, it's pretty hot. And here we have a slightly different... We're still in the allegorical framework in which the bride is his soul. Yeah? His soul is the bride, God slash Jesus. There are specific discussions here which I won't enter, is the bridegroom, and he is inviting the bridegroom to enter his bride, which is Origen's soul. Now, what is different from perhaps what we've seen in the rabbi's interpretation, that this is an individual experience and not a collective one. I mean, the rabbis speak of the Torah and the scholars of the Torah or of Israel. I mean, the bride is some kind of collective, some kind of political religious entity, which is together the bride, the community of Israel. For Origen, it's an individual soul. So that, but we do have the same kind of, even perhaps even more erotic writing, in which his soul, this really has to do with perhaps your interpretation of this earlier, his soul being the bride, because of that he can speak in the same first body voice. He can say the verses, his left hand is under my hand, and his right hand will embrace me. Because his soul is the bride, and therefore the me is identified, this female me is identified with the male origin. And in a sense, which is in a sense more detailed and therefore also more erotic in many ways, but this is the same origin saying, if you recall, that you have to forget, you have to, you know, put aside your bodily lusts and your flesh and blood in order to read the Song of Songs. But once he's done that, this text is highly erotic, him becoming the woman, inviting God to enter him slash her, and in what he calls a spiritual embrace. So we have the same kind of technique at the same time taking place in our Christianity alongside Rabbinic Judaism of interpreting this text allegorically and identifying with the woman in both cases, which is an interesting moment there. Yes, please. Oh, no? Okay. Yes.
It seems to me that it's very much a Christian concept because all he has to do is really love.
Mm-hmm.
And put on, you know, just show a lot of love. He doesn't have to do good deeds. He doesn't have to study Torah. He doesn't have to do all kinds of things that Jews have to do.
Yeah.
But all he has to do in order to get God to, or Jesus, to love him like the bridegroom, mm-hmm. who loves the bride,
yeah.
is to just show his love and attract
yeah. yeah.
somehow.
Interesting.
Which is an emotional kind of mm-hmm. thing and less of a...
Possibly, very possibly, yes.
I just say that this is an individual experience, a relationship, individual in the relationship with God.
Yeah.
Okay. We talk more in the communal or the community embracing.
Yeah.
Not so much the individual.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. You will have some Christian allegorical interpretations that will say that the she in the story is the church, and then will be something a bit more collective. But definitely, this text, I agree. It's an individual, and perhaps therefore perhaps part of the when you said it's a hot text, the fact that it is individual allows for its eroticism to be more understandable to us. I mean, in a sense, when we speak about the woman being the Torah and her breasts are like cows, this still sounds strange. I mean, it doesn't sound like an erotic text. We have to kind of explore what might be erotic in it. This text sounds erotic, even although he speaks in spiritual terms altogether.
I think it's really especially foreign to us when we talk about that, if in fact we haven't experienced the Torah in that context.
Yeah.
Which some have.
And then you would understand this
then
point.
Then you would understand that.
What's erotic. Yes, please.
You know, when I think about it, the relationship between God and Israel, you know, as I sense it from the various texts I remember, you know, it's one of two things, and I suppose they're really interrelated tremendously. You know, one is as a covenant, a brit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's a fairly rational transaction. You do A, B, and C, I'll do D, E, and F, and therefore, well, it's almost like a business relationship. Mm-hmm. I mean, the point is both sides have to perform various things for the other, and that works,
yeah.
Or it doesn't work.
Yeah.
However, you know, that's too stale. There also has to be the passionate relationship,
mm-hmm.
of which all this is are a different metaphor.
Right.
And, of course, the relationship between them is that, you know, passion comes and goes, but if you're going to have a long-term relationship, it also has to somehow have a real agreement, a real exchange between the parties, which can have a more, business-like aspect to it. But one without the other doesn't seem to work.
That's true.
The passion alone, or the transaction alone.
It's interesting.
Work. It's got to somehow combine.
We are a practical group.
It's interesting because the Song of Songs is really there is nothing of the contractual aspect of it. It's just passion. They're not married. They're not supposed to be married. We don't know. There's nothing of it. It's interesting that there is a trend in Midrash which we didn't really discuss here of locating the Song of Songs as some kind of historical moment in the history of the Jews. It's not just the ongoing love, but there's a historical moment. Several historical moments are possible candidates. One is the building of the temple, that's one. One is the opening of the sea. Oh, how would you say that?
Departing.
The departing of the sea. And one which is very prominent is the moment in Mount Sinai in which they received the Torah, which in many other Midrashim is described as a wedding, with God usually as the bridegroom, Israel as the bride, and Moses as the... best man, yeah, moving back and forth and trying. And the Mount Sinai is an interesting moment because it has a contractual aspect to it. You can really think of this moment in Mount Sinai as a moment of signing up the covenant, right? And we'll do this, you'll do that. This is, you know, the text of the covenant is the Torah itself. But by kind of saying the Song of Songs has been given to Israel or has been written about this moment of Mount Sinai, and everything going taking place here is about that moment. It's an interesting option, if I continue your what you said, of infusing passion into this moment and saying this is not just a contract. This wedding, which is in Jewish law a contract, it's not this wedding is not just a contract. It has the Song of Songs kind of underlying it.
Well, maybe that was Rabbi Akiva's real meaning, mm-hmm. or his real intention. After all, he spent all of his life studying Torah and interpreting law.
Yeah.
He was certainly sensitive
to the
contractual aspects, but what he was saying was that alone wasn't enough to mm-hmm. embody the whole relationship.
That's true.
If there wasn't a core of passion in there, of which this is the externals,
mm-hmm.
then it would last.
That's true. I think this, you can really see several statements of Rabbi Akiva which will really work well with what you're offering here. Let's take perhaps, a 5-minute break, because we're running late.
I would like now to... I would like now to take a look at a specific... some kind of afterlife of part of the allegorical imagery that the Song of Songs offers... in the Christian Middle Ages, and this has to do, I think, and this will have also much impact on later literature, Western literature. This has to do with the spaces in which the act of love is being imagined in the Song of Songs. And one of the major spaces that this act is being imagined in is the garden. And I would like to trace how this image of the garden is being interpreted. First, what happens a bit in the text itself, how it's being interpreted by early Christianity and in the Middle and in the Middle Ages, and then how this all sums up in Boccaccio's De Camera. So the Guardian appears in two ways in the Song of Songs, which are intertwined and sometimes confusing. On the one hand, the garden is sometimes the place where the act of love is imagined to take place. For example, the woman says to the man, let me find this for a minute. I think it's kind of it could have a double meaning, so I'm trying to find something which is a bit more I won't find it now. Just a minute, sorry. We'll have in a minute. Yeah, so, okay, that's actually the other side. Let's start with this. This is the easy one. The one aspect is that the woman herself is being described as a garden, and this is a paradigmatic text for this. A garden enclosed is my sister, yeah? She is imagined as a garden.
But here, in 6:2, says, my beloved has gone down into the garden.
Okay,
she gathered spices, she's eaten the garden.
And this, but there's also another one which I'm trying to find, and now I've kind of lost it for a minute.
What I just read?
This is actually an image that, this is 6:2. But there's also one, where is it now?
The one that I read was,
let us go to the vineyard in chapter 7.
Yeah, where's that? That's the one.
7:12.
Good, thank you.
4:12.
7:12. Yeah, here's a good example for that. 7:12 or even 7:10 begins, yeah? So why is it? No, I'm sorry. 7:11, I'm sorry. 7:11. I am my beloved and my desire is towards me. Come, my beloved, she says. Let us go forth into the field. Let us lodge in the villages. Let us get up early to the vineyards. Let us see if the vine has flowered, if the grape blossoms have opened, if the pomegranates are in flower. There will I give thee my love. So one option is seeing nature. Here it's not specifically garden, but it's vineyards vineyards and fields. As the garden this space of nature as a space where love will take place. She says to him, let's go outside, let's run outside to the vineyards, to nature, we'll see everything blossoming, and there I will give thee my love. We can think of this contra the fact what we've seen a bit last week, that the city is a space which somewhat represses love. We recall the watchman walking around, beating her up, the fact that she can't go outside to the street and look out for it, but nature is the place where love can take place. It's a place of some kind of freedom, and of sensuality where they can make love. And this is in a sense you can find this later on in what we could call pastoral tradition, up until A Midsummer's Night Dream of Shakespeare, and As You Like It, in which the forest the city is the place which represses love, and you have to go outside to the forest in order to express your desires. And so the Song of Songs is one of the earlier moments in which nature outside, and nature is where love can be. But the other option, as we said, is the fact that she is a garden. An enclosed garden is my sister. Her body itself is being described as a garden. We've seen also specific nature imagery of her various body organs. So sometimes she is in the garden, or she wants to be in the garden, and sometimes she is the garden. And then we have these verses, for example, as you just mentioned in 6:2. In 6:2, for example, my beloved has gone down into his garden, which could have a double meaning. Either it's a real specific garden in which he's going to, or if she is the garden, that this could be some kind of sexual metaphor. Both options are there because the text offers us these two images of the garden. It's the space and it's her body as well, and they're both, and they're intertwined, and sometimes we have this ambivalence. I'm skipping a bit forward in order for us to make it on time. When we move to the Middle Ages and to Christian interpretation, the garden has an interesting role. All in all, you could say that the Christian Bible offers three paradigmatic gardens. One is the Garden of Eden. The second is the Garden of the Song of Songs. And the third is paradise. Now, in a sense, these three are have some kind of chronological order. The Garden of Eden is the lost garden of the past, the one that we have banished from, we were banished from, and we will not return. The paradise is the garden in which we will enter in the future. And the Garden of the Song of Songs has some kind of place in the present, in which we'll soon see which kind of place. And in all three, again, we're doing this, in all three, if we have in mind the allegorical interpretation that Christianity, as well as Judaism, took to the Song of Songs, all three have some kind of option of intimacy with God, either before the banishment in the Garden of Eden, where they walked and God was around, or in paradise, where we will be reunited, or in the Garden of the Song of Songs, as we've just seen, which is the space where God and whoever God loves, whether that is the church or the soul, will be together. So all of these are places of spiritual intimacy with God, past, present, and future. Specifically, in the allegorical interpretation, this garden, the one which we're talking about, which is of our interest today, this garden has been interpreted in various ways, allegorically, in Christian tradition. It has been interpreted as the soul, that the garden is the soul, especially the verse that we've just seen, the enclosed garden, the garden as a place which is enclosed and protected, into which not everyone may enter. So this enclosed garden has been seen as the soul of the Christian believer, which is guarded from evil and from temptations and is dedicated to God. Sometimes it has been interpreted as the church. We've seen these two options already. Sometimes it has been interpreted as the body of Virgin Mary or of the Virgin or of the virgin or virgins as a whole. The enclosed, if she's an enclosed garden, then she's also closed sexually, and therefore this is a virgin body. And the fourth interpretation, which is of our interest today, is the monastery. The enclosed garden, has been interpreted in medieval interpretations, is the monastery, which actually has a lot of sense, because many monasteries had gardens, I mean, as part of their producing their own food. So gardens are part of the monastery, and they are enclosed. So the monastery is an enclosed garden, literally. And it's also an enclosed garden in this sense of this trio, the place which is protected from the outside world, and where you can have some kind of spiritual harmony with God, as you had in the Garden of Eden, or you will have in paradise. The monastery is an option to have this protected, secluded garden where some kind of spiritual, where the spiritual connection can take place. So, now, I'm sorry. And where nuns are married to God. Exactly, and where nuns are married to God. And specifically in women, this image will become specifically strong for women's monasteries, for monasteries for nuns, because then you have a double meaning. The monastery is an enclosed garden, literally and I don't know, symbolically, and the nun's body is also an enclosed garden within an enclosed garden, in the sense that her body is closed and dedicated to God as the enclosed garden in the Song of Songs. So there we have this kind of double garden within a garden.
The male body, like the monks,
yeah.
The body is not considered a garden?
Not necessarily, because I think the notion, much of the discourse of male body versus female body has, I mean, usually the notion of openness and closeness is one which is related to the female body. The female body is one which could be opened or closed in this kind of imagery. The male body can be celibate, but biologically, I don't know, physically, there isn't this option of opening and closing which the female body does offer for this imagery. But of course, it does. But at least this is not something that this is not an option that they usually trace. They usually discuss the female body in this notions of openness and closing. And therefore, she can be discussed as an enclosed body. This is for her, or enclosed garden. This is an image that will work more for her.
At least on a literal level, wouldn't you expect a garden somehow to be associated with fertility, a place where things grow and develop?
Mm-hmm.
This seems to be quite divorced from that.
Yeah. Unless you think of it as a spiritual fertility.
Well, in order for it to grow, it has to be protected. Otherwise, it gets trampled upon or whatever. I mean, there is a containment. I mean, it's almost like anything else. I mean, in order to gain force and power, you usually have to contain something to give it an opportunity.
Part of the idea of the walls. I mean, we usually think of the walls as closing the nuns or the monks in, but it's also an option of protecting them from the outside, and then things can grow in this. And we can also remember that the Garden of Eden itself, for example, is now a enclosed garden. But since we've been banished, it's something we cannot return to. This notion of closed gardens appears also in these other gardens as well. I'm saying this has been very quick because what I really want us to do is read a text, of course. This text is one story, the Decameron, which is by Giovanni Boccaccio. This is considered one of the masterpieces of Italian literature from the 13th century. And yeah, we are in the 13th century. You have it all? You have enough copies? Yeah. Okay. This has been written in Italian or in Florentine by Boccaccio, and it's considered to be one of those texts that are bringing forth the notion of humanism and the Renaissance, although it's earlier. It's still a medieval text. The main plot, it's not exactly a plot, but the main frame of the story is that during the big plague, 10 young people, 7 women and 3 men, escape Florence, which is plague-ridden, into some villa in the mountains. And there they stay for 10 days. During these 10 days, they tell stories. Each one has to tell a story in each day, so we have 100 stories, usually on a topic. Some of them, not all of them, most of them. One of the gangs decides she's the queen or the king of the day. They declare a topic, and everybody has to tell a story about this topic. Usually, sometimes it's an open. Sometimes they have an open day where you can just tell whatever they want. Many of these tales are comic, not all. Some have a darker tone and tragically. Many of them are explicitly sexual and erotic, and this has been also kind of a scandalous book at its time. What I want us to look upon is one story. It's the first story of the third day. The topic of the third day is people who have been witty enough to receive what they wanted. So these are different stories about people who received what they were looking for, were looking after. Witty or clever enough, yeah, to receive, to get whatever they wanted. And this is the first story. I'm wondering whether we should just perhaps... No, we don't have time. So we'll read it together instead of breaking down into groups, but maybe we'll share their loud reading. So if somebody wants to start reading.
Sure.
Okay, let's start.
Fearless ladies,
not a few there are both of men and of women who are so foolish as to blindly believe that so soon as a young woman has been veiled in white and cowled in black, she ceases to be a woman and is no more subject to the cravings proper to her sex than if, in assuming the garb and profession of a man, she would
of a nun.
Nature of a nun.
What?
Of a
nun. Of a man.
It's interesting.
Interesting.
She would put on the oil of stone.
Yeah, I'm sorry. This translation, although it's very accurate, is kind of old. So it's awkward. It's an old language. I apologize for that.
Probably seven words in it, guy.
Yeah.
And if perchance they hear of aught that is counter to this, their faith, they are no less vehement in their censure than if some most heinous and unnatural crime had been committed. Neither bethinking them of themselves, whom unrestricted liberty avails not to satisfy, nor making due allowance for the proponent forces of idleness and solitude. And likewise, not a few there are that blindly believe that what with the hope and the spade and coarse fare and hardship, the carnal propensities are utterly eradicated from the tillers of the soil, and therewith all nimbleness of wit and understanding. But how gross is the error of such as so suppose, I, on whom the queen has laid her commands, and minded, without deviating from the theme prescribed by her, to make manifest to you by a little story.
Okay.
Wow, what a preamble.
It's easier from here on.
In this very countryside of ours, there was and yet is a convent of women of great repute for sanctity. Name it I will not, lest I should in some measure diminish its repute. The nuns being, at the time of which I speak, but nine in number, including the abbess and all young women. Their very beautiful garden was in charge of a foolish fellow, who not being content with his wage, squared accounts with their steward, and hired him.
Hide him back
to Lamporecchio, whence he came. Among others who welcomed him home was a young husbandman, Masetto by name, a stout and hardy fellow, and handsome for a contadino, who asked him where he had been so long. Nuto, as our good friend was called, told him. Masetto then asked how he had been employed at the convent, and Nuto answered, I kept their large and beautiful garden in good trim, and besides, I sometimes went to the wood to fetch the faggots. I drew water and did some other trifling services, but the ladies gave so little wage that it scarce kept me in shoes. And moreover, they are all young, and I think they are one and all possessed of the devil, for 'tis impossible to do anything to their mind. Indeed, when I would be at work in the kitchen garden, put this here, would say one, put that there, would say another, and a third would snatch the hoe from my hand and say, that is not as it should be. And so they would worry me until I would give up working and go out of the garden, so that what with this thing and that, I was minded to stay there no more. And so I am come hither. The steward asked me before I left to send them anyone whom on my return I might find fit for the work, and I promised. But God bless his loins, I shall be at no pains to find out and send him anyone.
Should somebody want to continue? Yes.
As Nero thus ran on, Macedo was seized by such desire to be with these nuns that he quite pined as he gathered from what Nero said that his desire might be gratified. And as that could not be, if he said nothing to Nero, he remarked, 'Ah, 'twas well done of thee to come. one hip. A man to live with woman, with women, he might as well live with so many devils. Six times out of seven, they know not themselves what they want. There the conversation ended. But the pseudo began to cast about how he should proceed to get permission to live with him. He knew that he was quite competent for the services of which Nudo spoke, and therefore no fear of failing on that score. But he doubted if he should not be received, because he was too young and well-paid. After much pondering, he fell into the following train of thought. The place is a long way off, and no one there knows me. If I make believe that I am dumb, doubtless I shall be admitted. Whereupon he made his mind up, laid a hatchet across his shoulder, and saying not a word to any of his destination, set forth intending to present himself at the convent in the character of a destitute man. Arrived there, he had no sooner entered than he chanced to encounter the steward in the courtyard, and making signs to him, as dumb folk do, he let him know that of his charity he craved something to eat, and that, if need were, he was split firewood. The steward promptly gave him to eat, and then set before him some logs, which Nudo had not been able to split. All which the noodle,
the
but all which the cedar, who was very young, split in a very short time. The steward, having occasion to go to the wood, took him with him, and there set him to work on the lopping, which done, he placed the ass in front of him, and by signs made him understand that he was to take the loppings back to the convent. This he did so well that the steward kept him for some days to do one or two odd jobs. Whereby it so befell that one day the abbess saw him and asked the steward who he was. "Madam," replied the steward, "is a poor deaf mute that came here a day or two ago craving alms. So I have treated him kindly and have let him make himself useful in many ways. If he knew how to do the work of the kitchen garden and would stay with us, I would be able
to... I doubt not
we shall be well served. For we have need of him, and he is strong and will be able for whatever he might turn his head to. Besides which, we would have no cause to be apprehensive, lest he should be cracking his jokes to the young women. As I trust in God," said the abbess, "thou sayest sooth. Find out if he can do the gardening, and if he can, all that canst to keep him with us. Give him a pair of shoes, an old hood, and speak him well, make much of him, and let him be well fed. All which the steward promised to you."
Thanks. You want to
know? Masetto, meanwhile, was close at hand, making as if he were sweeping the courtyard, and heard all that passed between the abbess and the steward. For each he briefly commanded to himself on his wise, "Put me once within there, and you will see that I will do the work of the kitchen garden as it never was done before." So the steward set him to work in the kitchen garden, and finding that he knew his business excellently well, made signs to him to know whether he should stay. And he made answer by sign that he was ready to do whatever the steward wished. The steward then signified that he was engaged, told him to take charge of the kitchen garden, and showed him what he had to do there. Having other matters to attend to, he went away and left him there. Now, as Masetto worked there day by day, the nuns began to tease him, and make him their butt, as it commonly happened that folks served the dumb, and used bad language to him, and worse they could think, or supposing that he could not understand them, all which passed scarcely heeded by the abbess, who perhaps deemed him as destitute of ability or speech. Now, it so befell that after the hard day's work, he was taking a little rest, when two young nuns, who were walking in the garden approached the spot where he lay and stopped to look at him, while he pretended just to be asleep. And so the bolder of the two said to the other, if I thought thou wouldst keep the secret, I would tell thee what I have some time to meditate on, of which thou perhaps mightest also find agreeable. And the other replied, speak thy mind freely, and be sure that I will never tell a soul. Whereupon the bold one began, I know not that thou hast ever considered how close we are kept here, and if within these precincts there never enter any man, unless it be the old steward or this mute. And I have often heard from ladies that have come hither that all the other sweets that the world has to offer signify not a jot in comparison to the pleasure that a woman has in connection with a man. Well, I have more than once been minded to make excitement with this mute.
Experiment
with this mute, no other man being available. Nor indeed could one find any man in the whole world to so meet therefore, seeing that he could not glad if he would. Thou seest that he is but a dull, clownish lad, whose size has increased out of all proportion to his sense. Wherefore I would fain that thou hast to say to it, alas, said the other, what is tis thou sayest? Knowest thou not that we have vowed our virginity to God? Oh, rejoined the first, think but how many vows are made to him all day long, and never one performed. And so for our vow, let him find others for others to perform it, another for others to perform it. But said her companion, suppose that we conceive, how then? But nay, just the first, thou goest about to imagine evil before it befalls thee. Time enough to think of that when it comes to pass. There will be a thousand ways to prevent it ever being known. So only do we do not publish it ourselves, so long as we do not publish it ourselves. Thus reassured, the other was now more eager of the two to test the quality of the male human animal. Well then, she said, how shall we go about it? And was answered, thou seest 'tis past none. I make no doubt that all the sisters are asleep except ourselves. Search we through the kitchen garden to see if there be any there. And if there be none, we have but to take him by the hand and lead him hither to the hut, where he takes shelter from the rain. And then one shall mount guard while the other has him with her inside. He is such a simpleton that he will do just whatever we bid him. No word of this conversation escaped Masetto, who being disposed to all to obey, hope for nothing so much as that one of them would take him by the hand. They, meanwhile, looked carefully all about them, and satisfied themselves that they were secure from observation. Then she that had broached the subject came close up to Masetto and shook him, whereupon he started to his feet. So she took him by the hand, with blandishing air, to which he replied with some clownish grins. Then she led him into the hut, where he needed no pressing to do what she desired of him. Which done, she changed places with the other, as loyal comradeship required. And Masetto, still keeping up the pretense of simplicity, did their pleasure. Whereupon they, before they left, each must indeed make another essay of the music powers of riding, and afterwards, taking the matter over many times, talking the matter, over many times, they agreed that it was in truth not less but even more delightful than they had been given to understand. And so, as they found convenient opportunity, they continued to go and disport themselves with the news.
Yes.
Now it so chanced that one of their gossips, looking out of the window of her cell, saw what they did and imparted it to two others. The three held counsel together whether they should not denounce the offenders to the abbess, but soon changed their mind and came to an understanding with them, whereby they became partners in Macedo. And in course of time, by divers chances, the remaining three nuns also entered the partnership. Last of all, the abbess, still witting not of these doings, happened one very hot day as she walked by herself through the garden to find Macedo, who now rode so much by night that he could stand very little fatigue by day, stretched at full length asleep under the shade of an almond tree, his person quite exposed in front by reason that the wind had disarranged his clothes, which the lady observing, and knowing that she was alone, fell a prey to the same appetite to which her nuns had yielded. She aroused Macedo and took him with her to her chamber, where, for some days, though the nuns loudly complained that the gardener no longer came to work in the kitchen garden, she kept him, tasting and retasting the sweetness of that indulgence which she was wont to be the first to censure in others. And when at last she had sent him back from her chamber to his room, she must needs send for him again and again, and made such exorbitant demands upon him that Macedo, not being able to satisfy so many women, bethought him that his part of mute, should he persist in it, might entail disastrous consequences. So one night, when he was with the abbess, he cut the tongue string and thus broke silence. "Madam, I have understood that a cock may very well serve 10 hens, but that 10 men are sorely tasked to satisfy a single woman. And here am I expected to serve 9, a burden quite beyond my power to bear. Nay, by what I have already undergone, I am now so reduced that my strength is quite spent. Therefore, either bid me Godspeed, or find some means to make matters tolerable." Wonderstruck to hear the supposed mute thus speak, the lady exclaims, "What means this? I took thee to be dumb." "And in sooth, madam, so was I," said Macedo, "not indeed from my birth, but through an illness which took from me the power of speech, which only this very night have I recovered. And so I praise God with all my heart." The lady believed him, and asked him what he meant by saying that he had 9 to serve. Macedo told her how things stood, whereby she perceived that of all her nuns there was not any but was much wiser than she, and lest if Macedo were sent away, he should give the convent a bad name. She discreetly determined to arrange matters with the nuns in such sort that he might remain there. So, the steward having died within the last few days, she assembled all the nuns, and her own past errors being fully avowed, they by common consent and with Macedo's concurrence resolved that the neighbors should be given to understand that by their prayers and the merits of their patron saint, Macedo, long mute, had recovered the power of speech, after which they made him steward, and so ordered matters among themselves that he was able to endure the burden of their service. In the course of which, though he procreated not a few little monastics, yet 'twas all managed so discreetly that no breath of scandal stirred until after the abbess's death, by which time Macedo was advanced in years and minded to return home with the wealth that he had gotten, which he was suffered to do as soon as he made his desire known. And so Macedo, who had left Lamporecchio with a hatchet on his shoulder, returned thither in his old age, rich and a father, having by the wisdom with which he employed his youth, spared himself the pains and expense of rearing children, and averring that such was the measure that Christ meted out to the man that set horns on his cap.
Thank you. Okay. So, this tale, there are many ways to approach it. I will just take one strand out of it in order to kind of sum up our discussion today. This tale makes very specific use of the role of the garden in medieval symbolism. I mean, the garden there is a specific garden, there is a garden, but this garden is always echoes the garden as convent and the garden as body, which the Song of Songs is the impetus to this image. It already begins with this notion of with this moment in which Mazzetto says, "Let me in, and I will show you how I can tend your garden as in a way nobody else has." And this already has some kind of sexual undertone to it. Continuing with them complaining that the abbess is taking the gardener from them, and ending with this statement at the end, which is which needs perhaps a bit unpacking, that all that he won is what Christ meted out to the man who set horns on his calves. Now, the notion of setting horns is this image of cuckoldry, yeah, of making Christ a cuckold, in which the women, the wives of Christ, in this case the nuns, are cheating on Christ with the gardener, right, with Mazzetto. So now, if we return to this medieval imagery, then if the Garden of the Song of Songs, this enclosed garden, is in Christian imagery, becomes from the space of bodily, corporeal, sexual love, which it has been in the Song of Songs, it turns to become into a spiritual space, the covenant and the virgin's body, in which the beloved, the male beloved, is Jesus or is Christ, and the garden, she is the garden, wedded to Christ. Here, Boccaccio uses this imagery, the Christian religious imagery, and takes it back into its sexual source in the Song of Songs. The garden is actually the place where real flesh and blood sex will take place, but it is already charged by the religious and spiritual meanings that medieval Christianity has given to the garden. So in order for the garden to be a strong image in the text, it has to actually work with both. It returns to the original Song of Songs corporeal meaning of the garden, but only by kind of subverting the religious spiritual meaning of the garden as convent and the garden as nun. These images that Christianity has developed is now being subverted. It's being used in order to return back to the corporeal sexual source, which is the Song of Song itself. And therefore, this enclosed garden into which Mazzetto penetrates as the gardener and replaces perhaps Jesus as gardener. If Christ, Jesus is the gardener of the monastery, then he's now replaced, cuckolded by Mazzetto. Then we have here an interesting moment in literature that already uses these two strands, these two layers of the Song of Songs, the literal sexual bodily layer and the spiritual religious allegoric layer. Both of them are part of this text, but they are subverted. The relationship between them are subverted. What has already been understood to be spiritual and religious is now reread back again as sexual and carnal. And this is kind of part of what Boccaccio is doing, this kind of next phase in the impact of the Song of Songs in literature, is this kind of moving back from religion to the body, but still having the religious and allegoric interpretation in mind, and actually using it in order to make this story into a multi-layered and shrewd text. I'm sorry? Okay, I think that it's late. So we'll finish with this today. Next week we're not meeting, it's Purim. So we're having 1 week of break, and we'll be meeting again.